little bit ill-prepared, so, and this is a very hard thing to talk about, but we'll go ahead anyway. Now, when we do a week like this, where we have 25 different presentations, no, yeah, 25 different presentations in a week's time, there's a danger in that we can become so saturated that nothing makes any sense to us anymore. A sense of proportion is lost, or even a sense of priority, what is more important and what is less important. So this is beginning to happen. I could see it last night already. People were starting to get tired and they were starting to become satiated with too much thing, too many of these things. What we are doing in these talks is talking about a few things about the Rosicrucian exercises. And the things that we're saying are very simple. Hopefully, they're practical. They aren't so much focused on the exercises themselves, but things or questions that we have about them. And we're going to continue in that same way. In all of this, we've been a little bit intellectual, and we've been a little bit technical about it. And that's not always a good thing. One of the objectives of spiritual exercises is for us to become in control of all of our inner faculty. Control is critical, because if we don't have control of our inner faculties, someone else will, or something else will. In good cases, it's something like the tutelary spirits that guide us or that work through astrology. But in some cases, there are malevolent beings who will try to take control of us if we don't take control ourselves. So it is important that when we work with any spiritual exercise, that we work very carefully, we work very consistently, we work steadily. We do not want to have interrupted consciousness. This is why we develop technique. Because the better the technique, the better the results we're going to derive from that. But there is a danger of becoming a technophile. And we get all caught up with the means rather than the ends. So that we're thinking about the technicalities of what we're doing in our exercises and not the purpose or the purposes for which we are doing them. Now, I'm a person who likes literature. And these days, I don't have a lot of time to do reading. And I'm a sucker. I really like it if there are pretty arrangements of words, especially if those words carry a lot of meaning. And the perfect antidote for being too technical or being too intellectual can be found in literature. Yesterday we looked at the horoscope of Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I've read a lot of Dostoevsky's novels and some of his short stories. And he has some beautiful things to say relative to the kind of outlook that we have on life. He says, compassion is the chief principle for human advancement. Not intelligence, not a lot of other things, but compassion. Beautiful words. Those aren't the words that I'm thinking about. He has a, I'm gonna turn that fan off. In most of these stories of Dostoevsky, there is a lot of action. And in one of those stories, the protagonist who's telling the story is right in the middle of the hurly-burly of all kind of action. And he stops, and something comes to him, and he just blurts it all out. And he says, God is what it's all about. And that's the perfect antidote to something that is too technical or that is too intellectual. God is what it's all about. That's what should be foremost in our consciousness. Now the subject for this talk is prayer. And prayer is the method or a method for establishing intimacy with the universal spirit as it is focused in our being. And it's a very difficult subject to talk about. If we have a religious background, it is a subject that's often covered by a lot of ritual or a lot of theological beliefs, many of which may have been discarded in our spiritual quest. If someone has a philosophical background, which includes the Rosicrucian philosophy, prayer might bring up all sorts of philosophical issues or theological issues, and one can get lost in them just as one can get lost in ritual. And then there is our personality. Sometimes when we are trying to establish intimacy with the universal spirit, we get all too concerned about what we're doing and how we're doing it. In fact, that's what this whole talk is about. And a person can become awfully neurotic about what one is doing. Of course, the inner adversary throws up all kinds of resistance to our being successful. Because if we are successful in prayer, and the universal spirit is drawn more and more through our individual spirit into our personal being, the days of the supremacy of the lower nature are few in number and they disappear all the more quickly. So let's start looking at some of the issues that are involved in prayer. Obviously, first issue can be stated in a question, what is prayer? What is prayer? The simplest and probably the best answer is prayer is thinking. However, it is a very special kind of thinking. Some people, when they do that, some people think in terms of words, some people think in terms of images, or they have other vehicles for their thoughts. They wonder whether they should use them when they are praying. Should I pray using words? Should I pray using images? Words or images, and sometimes they are one and the same thing, are the most common vehicles that we have for thoughts and the things that thought brings through. They are, or they represent, specific types of thought forms. So as long as we remember that the words or the images that we are using when we are thinking, and in this case when we are praying, are a vehicle. They are a form for receiving that spiritual truth, that spiritual substance, and that the words or images are not the reality themselves. It's all right to go ahead and do that. It's, you know, it is a form, and it's capable of holding things from the spirit. If we do not keep that fact in mind, what happens is the images But the words become icons, they become idols, and we are participating in a form of idolatry. I'm sure we have all encountered that in our life, where certain words are treated so sacred that the real meaning of them or what they used to contain is no longer there, and it's in some ways almost profitable. The thoughts themselves are not the reality either. They themselves are a receptive form. The thoughts are concrete vehicles for something that comes from beyond concretion, something that comes from the universal or transcendental spiritual worlds, where things, everything is abstract, where those wonderful things such as truth and love and goodness and all of those things are found in their imponderable totality or in their wholeness. If we allow concrete thoughts to become the reality, that also is a form of idolatry. And the result is the same, it's death. When the spiritual life is no longer inhabiting the thoughts or the vehicles that we use to bring thinking about, they're dead. It's just like going into a mortuary, and you look at that body, and there's nothing to see there. What they used to inhabit it is gone. And it's dead. It's a creepy feeling, you know. And you see other people crying over the body as if that's the whole big reality. That's not what your friend was. Your friend was the spirit that inhabited that and lived through that. And it's the same thing with prayer. Prayer or any kind of thought is alive. And it should be exciting. Not exciting in the same way that a horror movie is exciting, but exciting in a spiritually stimulating way. If you've ever read the dialogues of Plato and some of those beautiful arguments that Socrates has, and they get into the heat of an argument, and Socrates starts following a line of thought, he says, let's follow this and see where this goes. A lot of people think that thinking is cut and dry, that once you've done it, it's all over, and it's always the same. But if it is filled with the truth, if it is filled with the love and beauty that comes from the higher spiritual worlds, it's live. It's very exciting. If our inner work is not exciting, not that we should lose our equipoise, or that we should get so flustered that we aren't really living in reality, if our inner life is not exciting, then we're doing something wrong. This doesn't mean that we're going to have an abundance of miracles every time that we sit down to pray, or kneel to pray, or however we do it. But it does mean that it should happen sometime, or there must be the promise of it. It has to be experienced. And we're looking for the truth. And if the way that we're looking for the truth does not have a feeling of truth about it, we're probably looking the wrong way. If it doesn't have the life where the way Christ Jesus in the Bible speaks of life, you know, that a person lives or is alive in a way that they have never been before, probably we're not doing something right. Christ in the Bible says that my joy may be full in you. The spiritual life is not meant to be sterile. It's meant to be full. It's meant to be rich. We're meant to be filled with joy, because who would want to follow us, or who would we influence if we were glum? People want something that is uplifting to them. They want something where they're going to feel good about themselves. Because most people inwardly understand that they are sinners, at least most of us on the path, if we're honest with ourselves, we understand that we're sinners, and we want something positive. We all want that understanding that someday we're going to be people who do not do harm to others, and that our life is always positive. So that brings us to the next issue, the next question. And that question is, what is thinking? What is it that we are doing when we are thinking? Now this is something rather shocking to ordinary people when they read the Rosicrucian cosmic conception. The seers, the adepts that developed the Rosicrucian philosophy and that cross-checked it to make sure that it is all true, they claim that thinking is evacuation. Thinking is evacuation. That when someone forms a thought form in the region of concrete thought, which is where the thinking takes place, that thought form is hollow. It is vacuous. But we have to be careful about what hollow and vacuous mean on that realm, within that realm, because that's different from this realm. By hollow, it doesn't mean hollow like here in this three-dimensional world. It is an interdimensional kind of hollow. Vacuum in the world of thought is analogous to vacuum here. Here in the chemical region of the physical world, when we produce a vacuum, we empty a given space of the stuff of the chemical region of the physical world. There's no physical stuff there, or no chemical physical stuff there. No solids, liquids, or gases. But there still is etheric stuff in vacuum. We know that from physics. Rod can tell us that in the physics laboratory, that light passes through a vacuum. So the etheric stuff which bears the light, which bears the energy, is still there. Vacuum in the region of concrete thought is vacuum of the stuff of concrete thought. It's sort of like hollowing something out. It's hollowing thought stuff out. In that vacuum, in the region of concrete thought, when there is a vacuum from concrete thought stuff, that doesn't mean there isn't something in it. What is in it is the purest form of transcendental truth, universal ideas, or pure truth itself from the life spirit. So in the process of thinking or of evacuating, we are making a nest, so to speak, an intellectual nest or a mental nest for something to come and dwell in, something to abide in our thoughts. So in some ways, prayer, and even other thought, is like sucking cider through a straw. We draw out the material, and something comes flowing into that vacuum. Sweet apple juice, or something like that. But in the act of deep thinking, which is what prayer really is, this is a bilateral activity. On the phenomenal side, the personality produces the form it draws an emptiness. And at the same time that that thought form is being produced, simultaneously, the spirit in the transcendent part is focusing the self of spirit into that form. In fact, it is the wish of the spirit that is involved in the prayer that it wishes to express itself in that way. And it is only with the help of the personality and the lower nature becoming subservient or obedient to the spirit that we can produce that vacuum. We realize that there is something of a humility. There is a real taming of the lower nature in the process of prayer. We are humble. We're humble not by being admonished or by being punished or anything like that, but we are humble because we stand in awe before something that is very powerful, something that is divine. And even if that is our own spiritual self, the thinker, that is what is involved. Now, the capacity and the quality and the accuracy of thought depend on the ability of the thinker. Thinking, whether it is prayer or ordinary concrete thinking, is a skill. And one learns to develop this skill just like you learn to develop any other skill. The only difference is the skill is learning to build the thought form or to evacuate the space in the region of concrete thought according to the nature of the principle of the truth that we are trying to understand. Now, everything we're saying probably being said in too much of a roundabout way and too much of a way that is itself convoluted. But when we're thinking, there is an attitude. There is a stance. And from the viewpoint of the Rosicrucian philosophy, all concrete thinking is questioning. All concrete thinking is questioning. And if you don't believe this, watch yourself when you're thinking. Because when you're thinking, this is a sacred activity. And it's like every other activity, we can watch ourselves right in the process. We said this last night or the night before, that spiritual exercises are heuristic. You learn in the process of doing them. If you watch yourself, you say, how can this be? Like Eddie was saying this afternoon, how can this be that this apple suddenly falls from a tree and it is impelled to the ground? Or we say, why are things like this? Or where will this lead us to? We're always asking questions. And according to the quality of the question we ask, we get an answer. This is right at the beginning of cause and consequence, so that the quality of our question is the cause and the consequence is the answer to our question. If we ask anything long enough or deeply enough or correctly and we listen for the truth, and we ask in such a way that we believe there is an answer, because that belief in an answer is part of coaxing the spirit into the platform that we're building, you're going to get an answer. You can keep thinking, it may take you years and years and years, but as long as you keep that questioning in mind and keep at it, you're going to get an answer. It's impossible to think and not get an answer. Well, some things, if they are very subtle things, if very deep things, it may be a long time in coming. And when we do get an answer, it might be only a partial answer. We have to be careful about not jumping to a conclusion that this is the whole thing. Because we produce a thought form, complete thinking is imaginative. Incomplete thinking doesn't use the imagination. In fact, in incomplete thinking, people think that imagination is detrimental to the process of thinking. The form is taken as a truth, then that is correct. It becomes a superstition. The superstition is that the form is the reality and not the truth or the life that are within the form. When we're imagining a form, especially at this deep of a level, is asking a question. Can it or will it be like this? If we are an artist, we say, does this form produce the feeling that I want? And whether we are doing something that is completely visual, or if we're trying to imagine a musical form, because music is the language of the world of concrete thought, it is of that nature. It is producing a form. The word that we have that gives both the quality of questioning, or of sucking, so to speak, and imagining at the same time, is drawing. We are drawing something out, or we are drawing something into the concrete realms. Now, mind you, our thinking as human beings is very young, and it's very artificial, because we're not really at home with the spiritual worlds anymore, because we've been living in this materialistic superstition, which is one of the only places that we're really fully self-conscious. It's in this material world. We've been here so long that we've gotten into a bad habit. And in that bad habit, it seems to us that everything is like this world. That isn't really the way it is. So we're in material blindness. Spiritual thought is much more direct. And it's not artificial and indirect. About a year ago, I saw the Dalai Lama, and I especially liked the question and answer period with him. He did not use any dogma when he answered questions. People would ask him questions, and he went straight for the jugular. This is a man that you can see does concrete thinking, not just meditation without concretion. This is a man that has direct answers. And you can tell a person who is a thinker because they don't dance around it, especially if they are a prayerful thinker. They don't dance around the subject. They go straight at it. If we're thinking about something like a bird's wing, we can feel what it's like to be in the full of air. And by holding our consciousness on that, we can draw a shape that becomes the shape of a bird's wing, a very alar shape that is perfect for that. It's that same kind of thinking that, in a more imperfect way, produces airplanes. And the airplanes are klutzy, because they are so indirect, and there's so many things by brute force, but that's too much on the side. Now, some people don't like prayer. They think it is begging or asking for something. And because when people are usually praying in that way, this notion is correct. People are selfishly saying, I want this. I've even been in churches where it has been taught that if you pray right, you're going to become wealthy. This is very, very selfish. Fortunately, it also happens to be counterproductive, because if you're praying for something in a selfish way, the spirit, the universal spirit, is not selfish. And it is almost impossible for it to follow a selfishness. Because where there is questioning, and because questioning is what produces that vacuum, there is an asking. So for a few minutes now, let's take a little bit of an aside and examine how prayer is special thinking. One way that prayer is special thinking is that it is complete. Now, most people thinking that it's done in the world is not complete. Most of it is intellectual thinking. People are trying to solve problems mentally. And therefore, anything that isn't mental is detrimental or distractive to the process of thinking. And this is very effective. We understand all kinds of principles and things of that nature, but it's not complete. But if we look at prayer, prayer is complete thinking because it utilizes every part of our being. The former kind of thinking is helpful for solving a scientific problem, but most of the problems of life are not scientific problems. If a prayer is really a good prayer, there is feeling, there is desire, and there are good desires. All of our energy is directed into the process of praying, especially if we're praying for something that's very important and very critical, like we do in our healing prayers. Even our brain is brought into the process, and it asking with the entirety of our personality, when we ask using every bit of our being, we produce a vacuum. We really are empty in every part of our being. There's nothing in our brain, there's nothing in our energy, our desire is singular, we're open and empty in everything. That's a very good thing, because it unifies, despite accomplishing what needs to be accomplished by the prayer, such as healing. Just for the prayer, this is extremely helpful because it's unifying. Most of the time, we have conflicts in ourselves between one desire and another. Or we think one thing and we feel another. But if we have the entire personality focused on one thing, that produces a unity. We have to be careful again, because the inner adversary is very cunning, and it can insinuate itself into our prayer life, and it can pervert it if we're not careful. And we can get carried away in emotionalism. And if it's emotionalism, it disrupts us so that we can't produce the kind of vacuum that we need to be produced to be filled with life spirit for healing. By combination of cause and consequence, and the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below, the response to a prayer will be according to the character and quality of the question. It's no different than if we are a sculptor, we make a wax figure, and then we pack that wax figure in sand, and then we pour the molten metal into the figure, and the wax gets melted away, and the statue or the piece of sculpture that we do takes the shape of the sand form. The thought form that we produce, if it is unselfish, if it is true to the needs, is like making a form for molten gold. And that molten gold is spiritual gold. So this means that we're not only asking for things for other people, it means that we're desiring good things. And if we don't do anything else in the entire day but pray, maybe for a half an hour or something like that, we have drawn into ourselves, if we are earnest and honest and really work on what we're doing, we have drawn into ourselves something that is very divine. Something that is much more powerful than all the lower base things that occupy our consciousness the rest of the day. Something that is more long-lived than all the rest of the things that we do for the rest of the day. So just the very act of praying, especially praying for others where we bring things all the way through us, rebuilds our desire bodies. We become people of love. You don't accidentally become a person of love. You become a person of love by loving. And in this case, you're bringing love through of the best and highest quality. If we had materialistic values, we'd even pay to pray. What is happening when we are doing this, when we are evacuating a thought form, and a thought form with the intent of bringing in the deepest and highest spiritual stuff that we can think of, we are incarnating the spirit. We are bringing spirit more into matter. That's one of our evolutionary purposes. If we combine this with something purgative, like retrospection, which we're going to talk about tomorrow night, so that we're purging ourselves and are emptying ourselves of negative things, and through the activity of prayer, filling our consciousness with positive things, that's a 1-2 combination that's unbeatable. This is not a small thing. Meaning to say that even just a few minutes of simple prayer is doing something that is very, very wonderful. In another way, prayer is special in that it takes us back to something that we talked about in the very first talk. Prayer is a form of concentration. Therefore, practicing prayer, no matter how successful or unsuccessful we may be, brings our consciousness into a state of focus. Every part of our being is focused on one thing, the divine, the highest of all things. All of our vehicles are brought into concentricity. We are all together as we should be. Yes, there are kinds of concentration where our being is focused on other things, but they're not focused on the center of being itself. The being, the one. Now this brings up, since we're pretty much an intellectual crowd, we're people of the head, and we need to be somehow brought into being people of the heart, brings up some things that are little questions that nag at people. We have a certain amount of neurosis, and let's try to address some of those questions. And some of those questions are, when we are praying, to whom or to what are we addressing our prayer? Or what is the true nature of the communication? and what is the nature of the being that we are addressing. Now, when this question is asked of most people, if somebody were to walk up to you and say, to whom are you praying? And you would say, God. And a lot of people who are not spiritually inclined would look at you as if you're crazy. How can you be praying to God, you know? Most people who do pray, that is, for them, enough of an answer. But then we get into sophisticated philosophies like the Rosicrucian philosophy, and that answer is too simple. One would say, do you mean the God within, the self, or do you mean God, the center and creator of our solar system, which Max Heindel calls the purpose or the end of everything in our existence, the being that is behind the Trinity? Or do you mean the supreme being, the being that is behind everything, even the cosmic planes of which we have not the slightest notion? Or do you mean the absolute, which is totally unknowable? If you ask someone, what is God, you get another one of those looks, should I call the police? Now, there are some people that literally believe God is an old man with a beard. Some people will say, God is an intelligence just like my own, and I am talking to it. The more honest people will say, I can't explain or describe it, but I talk to it, and I get answers. Only rarely will you ask people what to whom they are addressing, or what God is. Only rarely do you hear the quote that comes direct from Christ. God is a spirit and must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. If one tries to learn about the nature of God, one encounters even more misunderstanding. In Buddhism, some think there is no God. At least not in the way that Western people think of it. Though there are many gods with a small g. Whether it is or it is not, even terms like spirit are not used. But its being and its characteristics or its attributes are discussed. To many, it seems very vague, and it seems very diffuse, as if one can't put one's finger on it, not even one's mental figure. The Rosicrucian philosophy has a very interesting notion about God. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, which does not disagree with Buddhism, God is an idea. This is another, if you state this to a lot of other people, this is another one they want to call the wagon to have you haul away. This is a very curious outlook. Spirit is spirit. Spirit is universal and cannot be concretized in any way. God is an idea that is conceived by spirit to reflect on itself. Our essential being, since we are created in the image of God, is also spiritual. But as individuals, ourselves, we are also ideas. The spiritual ego, with a capital E, which we now call self, is a divinely conceived idea, just as God is a divinely conceived idea to reflect on the nature of spirit. In the West, most of our notions of spirit are just the opposite of Buddhism, at the other extreme. In Buddhism, to us, it's too diffuse. In the West, there is the individuality, which is an attribute or the character of divinity, is taken as personality. People have a personal God. And as we just said a few minutes ago, they talk to that personal God as though they were talking to somebody on the street. It works, but not because that's the most effective way to go about it, and not because that's the most true way to go about it. Now, when we say things like this being too diffuse or this being too personalized, we're not trying to jeer at or make fun of anyone's religion. And we're not trying to make our outlook be superior to everything else. We're just looking at some of the misnotions, by working our way through them, we're trying to get to what the truth really is. My guess is that probably everybody in this room has intuitive experience. And that intuitive experience is not in words, even though it seemed like it, because that is what we have habituated ourselves to think of communication in terms of. And when we had that intuitive experience, it seemed like we as individuals were something special. And we are special. There's no reason why everyone can't be special. If everybody's individual, why can't they also be special in their individualness? This is an extremely difficult matter that we're trying to talk about. Even in very simple experiences, it's very difficult to talk about it. To determine what real spiritual experience is like. Because to some extent, it's new to us. We are little children, we really don't understand it. And it takes a lot of interpretation. We're like little children, and we almost have to be talked down to for us to get some of the things in the experience of spiritual things. So let's keep that in mind and try to begin to answer some of these hard questions that we've been dancing around. I dance around sometimes, and I don't like the Dalai Lama go straight for you part of the answer. In this, we'll try to not just give answers. We'll try to go as far as we can with them, but they probably won't be ultimate answers. The purpose of this talk is to get us all thinking about our prayer life, observing what we are doing and learning about them. It is to encourage each other to participate in prayer lives. Because it isn't easy, you know. Max Sandel tells us that our lives should become work and prayer. The reality of the matter is prayer is work. And it's not always easy work. To whom is one praying? Or to what is one praying? The answer I would give to that question that we've been dancing around is it doesn't make any difference. Not to say that we should be thinking of foreign gods or idolatries or things like that. But as long as we are focusing through the center of our own being and focusing on the center of spirit, it doesn't make any difference. We concentrically line up with everything as deeply as we can line things up when we pray. The centering makes that question irrelevant. Obviously, we have to work in the center of our own consciousness, that is, the self, in order to address any being. Prayer is an inward activity. And therefore, we have to look within, even if we're looking at a being that seems to be beyond ourselves. We have to center within ourselves. When we are in our dense physical bodies and we are speaking with somebody else in their dense physical bodies, we don't talk to the body. We don't communicate that way. I'm not talking to your bodies. I'm talking to something within you that is capable of knowing the truth, because we both share the same truth. And this is the way communication takes place. If you're just spewing thoughts out, you're not communicating. But if you are talking to people, not at them, is when you can communicate. You can penetrate. Because we spend so much time in this exclusively outward world, we have done so for so many lives, we've gotten into bad habits. And one of the worst of those habits is materialism. So that we think of everything that the truth included is without. We can verify the truth without by proving it, but really the truth is within. And once we begin to understand the orientation of inward intention, what we intend to do, most of the problems of prayer vanish. It is a matter of intending to do something and putting everything we have into that. We are putting something to the object of our intention. If that happens, we leave the center of being, center of divinity, we can focus on that within ourselves. Since the one is everywhere, its center is everywhere. And the realization of that is within us. And if we take that same realization as the point for focusing on that center, we can't help but to be successful. Again, these things are said because we have these mentalist illusions, and we sometimes get ourselves into those kinds of dilemmas that are basically neurotic. We don't have to direct ourselves in any direction of space or anything like that. We have to intend ourselves to represent your spirit. What is more important in prayer is the character of our focus. Some people may wish to call it the quality of our focus. And what we're going to talk about now are things which I have not been forced to accomplish. And the only way that I can hope to convey my vague understanding of truth is to be completely honest. I have not accomplished, even though I can understand what is at stake in all of this. The reason for even bringing this subject up is, but it is so important and it is so inspiring that it could never be forgotten. In order to get at this, I'd like to look at some wonderful statements by a German mystic named Meister Eckhart. And he was living at the same time that the Rosicrucian Order was founded in the early 14th century. In one case, Meister Eckhart says, one does not see God with the same eye with which one sees a cow. One does not see God with the same eye with which one sees a cow. That cuts through all materialism, even as it might apply to the desire world or any other material world. That's the negative. But he said something also that is in the positive, that is extremely enlightening and opening. He says, I see God with the same eye that God sees me. I see God with the same eye that God sees me. Now that is a profound statement. When we go deeply into prayer, in worship, in adoration, in love, and in thanksgiving, even when we're praying a prayer of thanksgiving, we're asking a question. And the person is really thankful. I've heard this statement many times. Ordinary people know the truth of it. They say, I'm so grateful, I don't know how to express my gratitude. They're questioning, how can I express my gratitude to you? That is question and thanksgiving at the same time. When we are looking God in the eye, we are looking into the eye of spirit. Now that is something. I have no qualms about the fact that my life is a profane life. It's not at all the life of a really solid spiritual aspirant. And it is a very, very difficult thing for me to even try to look the universal spirit in the eye. To look at the source of all truth, to look at the source of all goodness, to look at the source of all love, while being tainted with the impurities of my own life, it's a really hard thing. I can think of a very simple analogy, but even that analogy doesn't come anywhere near to be close to the purgative process of looking God in the eye. It's like if you take and drink grape juice. That's, I know, it's great to drink grape juice. But if we drink a whole bunch of grape juice, what happens? We have diarrhea. And that grape juice is doing just what it's supposed to do. It's cleaning us out. And if we try to address ourselves directly to the universal spirit, it does the same thing. Even just trying to do it purges us. It'll probably be a long time before I have the strength of character that I could look the universal spirit in the eye and say, I have done what you have asked of me. That takes a lot of character. It's a lot of strength. But it's a wonderful thing. You know that there are people in some parts of the world that take the sun literally as the focus of God, and they blind themselves by from sunrise to sunset. They look the sun in the eye. They physically blind themselves. They've got saying all along that all of our vehicles, the higher vehicles, desire, body, mind, they all get stronger in use. This is the highest and best use of that principle. If we try to directly address ourselves to the very eye, which is also the heart of the spirit, it strengthens us. We have talked, and all of you talked, about the division of our being between our true spiritual nature and the pseudo-self, the first and second self. Most of us are aware of it in its incompletion. We are aware of the struggle within ourselves. And in terms of prayer, the light of this becomes all the more clear. This is the specifics. We know what we are when we confess, because the looking of God in the eye is a form of confession. You're looking at the light that's going to illumine everything in your being, no matter how shadowy it may be. This is the specific of that. This throws life on our divided being and the struggle within our divided being. It's something like in a dream. In a dream, you are watching, you are acting whatever the action of a dream is. At the same time that you are acting out in the dream, you're watching at the same time. And you're watching not as though from a distance, but within the part that is doing or acting out the activity of the dream. This very same thing, this duality of our being, is what happens in the depths of prayer. When one tries to focus on the center of all things in worship, in thanksgiving, and in help, in the need for all of us, one is watching oneself while praying. It's very hard to get away from this divided self. You're watching yourself while you're doing it. Sometimes you're even, if you're anything like me, you're even commenting on the quality of your performance, how sincere you are, how concentrated you are. And when it comes to the point, you realize that both the watcher and the doer must be unified and must be directed into that center. That's where the resistance of the lower nature comes up the most. One is afraid. One is afraid that you're going to lose who you are. And even though you rationally know that your selfhood, your being high and low, is a divine creation and it's not going to be wiped out, you still have that kind of panic. And in order for prayer on this level to be sincere and to be true, one must take the watcher and the doer and unify them and put them into looking into the eye of God. Let's take the last few minutes and look at a little something else. And we're looking at divine communion, divine communication. Let's try to clear up one or two more misconceptions and come to a better understanding of what we're trying to do. It would be very nice if everybody in the group could stand up on consecutive nights and tell what they have learned by doing prayer. Because when you pray all alone, and even though you're looking for
and self-education, it's really helpful to find out what other people have learned. I used to try to learn how to play guitar, and it was really interesting to see kids. They would learn how to play certain chords on the guitar, and they'd get together with their friends and see what I've learned. And that's the kind of spirit that I looked at these seminary schools and conferences and when we get together, when we really try to share what we've learned along the way. And sometimes we're corrected because we end up being right. But at any rate, that's what we're trying to do this. There used to be a man when I had the bookstore open and it was open for public conversation. There was a man who came in that was a man who thought for himself. And he was a self-ordained thinker. He was not always a really deep thinker, but he was, certainly wasn't shallow. And he always wasn't a correct thinker. He made errors, but the thing was, is he kept on thinking. And he had a theory about the nature of Christ Jesus we took from physics. That idea was that if you have a barrel of stones, there is an average stone as far as size and as far as density and mass, that there was an average stone, and that every stone in that barrel, even if there wasn't a perfect average stone, related to that theoretical average stone. And he thought that this is how it was with Christ Jesus. He thought that Christ Jesus was the perfect average man, and the reason that he could relate to everyone was because he was perfectly average, and in that perfect average, he had a communion with everyone else. Unfortunately, when pointed out to him several times, if he was the perfect average man, he would not have been able to teach the wise men. So he had to be somebody who was special. The idea that the universal spirit could lower itself or transduce itself to any level, just as it does in the creation of all the worlds, the way Eddie was talking about it this afternoon, Eddie and Dan were talking about it this afternoon. To his credit, he was headed in the right direction. Christ Jesus did have something in common with every human being, but it was not something like an arithmetic mean. It was exactly what Christ said it was. I am the truth. I am the light. Christ also said, I am in you, and you are in me. As a living expression, he was a focus of the truth. Not a truth, not a principle, but the truth, the truth out of which all things were made, life spirit, the love and wisdom and knowledge and everything becomes unified, the truth that is within all things. And this is what was in common. All of ourselves partake of the selfness of the life spirit. And it was that the Christ was the focus of. Thus, anybody who is sufficiently conscious can be cognizant of that. In the Christian mystic initiation, one of the first things that happens in that initiation is one knows who one is as a self, as a God, as a divinely conceived idea, a child of God.
but one also knows who one is in relation to Christ, in relation to that love, wisdom, truth. That is an indubitable thing, so that one both realizes divinity and something that transcends our focus of divinity. Thus, when it seems as if the voice of God speaks to us in our prayers, it isn't a personality. And we shouldn't or couldn't really ultimately prefer it to be so. However, the form in which it comes to us may be words, and it's certainly determined by the nature of what our character is and what its limitations are. The truth is from the Spirit, and the words are from us. So as we become individuated, and especially as we become more personally individualized, there is a great danger of personalization and personalizing the divine relationship, which is another way of warning us not to be focused on ourselves or to be thinking of ourselves when we are looking into the eye of God, but to unify our whole being and give ourselves to dive into the cauldron that is the center of God. Let's practice a little bit by reading the Rosicrucian Students prayer.
That we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable unto thee, O Lord.